You're listening to Repcast, the official podcast of San Diego Repertory Theater. This episode features Talking Theater with Todd, How We Birth World Premiere Theater. It was recorded live Thursday, March 10th, before the 7 p.m. performance of R. Buckminster Fuller, History and Mystery of the Universe.
So welcome. This is the first night of first preview of the History and Mystery of the Universe. It's a very special part of our 40th season to bring back one of the most successful new plays ever done at the Rep, a play that's gone on to be performed around the country and around the world. And now it's coming back in our 40th season, and we're excited to welcome Doug Jacobs and Ron Campbell, the show about Buckminster Fuller. And of course, it's really wonderful to be here, and we thank Peter Meisen for hosting us tonight. Thank you very much to be here. So what we want to talk about today is new play development at San Diego Rep. We are an unusual theater in that we do a lot of new plays every year, History and Mystery of the Universe possibly being one of the most successful. And I gathered a panel of people who've all worked on new plays at the Rep, and I'd like to introduce them. So right to my right is Dawn Moore, and to her right is Danielle Ward, and to her right is a Bernie, Herbert Seguenza. Just reading the buttons. I wonder if you could tell the group the different plays that you've worked on at the Rep that you've been involved in the development of.
All right. I've worked on, as dramaturg, on a couple National New Play Network Rolling World premieres. So I've worked on The Exit Interview, which was starring Herbert Seguenza, and Uncanny Valley, and also I worked on Tortilla Curtain, which we did a one-week workshop of, and then about a year later did a full production of it.
Great. And Danielle?
As a litter manager at the Rep, I have a hand in dramaturgy on a lot of the pieces, but my favorite is when I get to actually focus and call myself a dramaturg on the specific new works. And I've worked with Dawn on The Exit Interview. We were co-dramaturgs for a lot of theaters in the nation, actually, on that one. But also Federal Jazz Project, Herbert's Steel Heaven, Todd's Hammer, A Bell, and A Song to Sing. And currently, right now, I'm working on Into the Beautiful North by Karen Zacharias.
And Herbert, you have premiered several pieces here at the Rep. What are the new plays you've developed here?
Yeah, I'd like to go back. I'm a founding member of Culture Clash. And back in the 90s, we were commissioned to write a play called Border Town, which at that time we were going around. We were doing site-specific work where we would interview people, residents of a certain town, and put their stories on stage. And we did that. We came, I think, in 1998, and came to San Diego, lived in San Diego, interviewed about 60 people, and put their stories on stage. So this was a new work where it was, you know, based off actual interviews of San Diego residents. And then we, then many years later, 5 years ago, I came with after working with Culture Clash all these years, we've written about 20 plays over our 30-year history. But 5 years ago, I came with an idea to San Diego Rep about writing a one-man show about the life of Pablo Picasso. and I had this idea based off a book of photographs by Douglas Duncan called The Private Life of Pablo Picasso. And they said, great, write a couple of scenes. And so I went back and I wrote a couple of scenes, and we actually did them. I mounted them after a show. I think it was, forgot the show.
It was Doubt.
Doubt. I did like a half hour, and people responded very well, and that motivated me to go back and write the full-length play called The Weekend with Pablo Picasso. And that's been one of my most successful plays as well, having now toured it at eight different regional theaters around the country over the past 5 years, and it's been a real, real success for me. And after that, I wrote an adaptation of Shakespeare's Henry IV that was produced last year by La Jolla, 2 years ago by La Jolla and San Diego Rep for their WOW Festival. And we could talk about that later, how I've adapted classics because I'm adapting one right now, based off the Imaginary Invalid by Molière, and so based off another classic. So we'll talk about all that. But so far I've written 4 plays, I think, for San Diego Rep, and Steel Heaven's another one, and N.L. Henry, and the Manifest Destinitis, which I'm writing right now, is awesome. So 4 plays, I've been 4 new works that have come out of San Diego Rep.
And since we're sharing resumes, I've developed The Blessing of a Broken Heart at San Diego Rep, A Hammer Bell and a Song to Sing. And next year I'm doing a new play called The Dybbuk for Han and Sam's Wedding. One of the things that ties a lot of these plays together is, you know, they're not traditional write a imaginary story about 4 characters who come over to a professor's house after a dinner party and have big arguments and things are revealed at the end and there's a lot of tears. A lot of the work that we're creating is actually from material that exists. Certainly Picasso is, this play is, the Dybbuk is. And I wonder if we could start to talk about that process at all. Herb, when you're starting with something where there's text that you're adapting, what do you look for in, you might use Picasso as an example, what do you look for in source material to create a play?
It's a good question. I mean, it comes down to what resonates with, for me, you know. In Picasso had a large 80 years of work and philosophy of art, you know. He was basically the father of modern art, and so he spoke a lot about art, which can get really esoteric and not theatrical enough, you know. And that's I'm always looking at, when I look at text, I have to look at it as, well, is this theatrical? Is this entertaining to say, you know? And so it has to resonate with me, and it also has to be dramatic, theatrical, whatever I'm looking for at that moment.
I have the same thing with the play Blessing of a Broken Heart that I did, is I read the source material and I heard it on stage. And to me, it sounded theatrical when I read it. There was an intensity to the language, maybe like a compact energy of the language, so that a few, you know, let's say the opening line of Blessing of a Broken Heart is, a cave is a place of constriction. Mm. I'm just like, oh. Mm-hmm.
There's your start right there.
You know, it sounds good. It has resonance. Mm-hmm. So I guess for me, when I look for things, it's just the way it's phrased strikes me as powerful. When you say that source material feels theatrical, what does that mean to you?
Well, for example, on A Weekend with Pablo Picasso, the first line is, everything is possible. Everything is a miracle. That's what he says. Everything is a miracle. So, it, you know, just that line alone gives you the freedom, or at least gives you the idea what the play is about. And the play is about everything. It's about, you know, the magic of art and the possibilities of art. And so we stuck to that, you know, theme, you know. I think the first line sometimes suggests the whole play.
One of the things that we work really hard at in developing a play is creating a structure. I think it's one of the things that, I guess when you see the way a house is built, you know, you see the outside, but you don't really know the bones of it. But I guess anyone who's an architect will tell you it's the structure that, you know, that contains everything that you watch on the outside. And the same is true for a play. When you're building the sequence of a play, Danielle, what are you looking for structurally in how to sequence things in the creation of a new work, particularly one that's based on existing sources?
Well, I think one of the best things about the Rep is that our development process is unique for each play. And so I don't think that there's one prescription for each piece that you can say, I look for A, B, then C to exist. I mean, of course, you want to have an interesting character, and of course you want to have something happen to that character and them to grow, and that you watch that growth happen and that you get invested in it. I mean, because those are some of the tried and true things that work when you're watching any sort of piece of theater or film. But I think one of the things that, that I appreciate about the reps process is that we meet each piece as it is. And so, for example, I loved working with Herb on Steel Heaven, where it just started out as putting all of Abby Hoffman's monologues and his everything that you had collected that you heard him say in one long swath, and then trying to source out, well, you can't just stand up there and say all of these things, right? And then that became, okay, well, now we need somebody for him to talk to other than the audience, and where the frame was, and the frame for that particular piece, because we were dealing with it individually, happened to be this creative idea of him being in heaven and then him helping somebody new. So makes it to make it contemporary and also to acknowledge where he was in the past and also give him power in a very comical way, which is you, right? And so the idea of helping to create this framework, then everything fell into place. He's going to be there to help a younger person understand how to become a protester, but then who is he going to talk to, and how are who's going to be the other cast of characters that help? And so that development
first
process
it was a male actor
from one person to two person to actually three people, and that third person playing multiple roles in heaven, you know, that process happened. And I think I have learned, I just was reflecting the other day that especially when you're dealing with source material, I have an idea about what that source material might be, especially with a background as a writer that I, if I were doing it, I would do X, right? Mm-hmm. But there, I am not the writer. You are the writer, or the other person is the writer, and so I'm there to help and support. And so it's important, because there's a source material already out there in the world that is in existence, it's not just in your brain, it's important for the dramaturg or the director or somebody else who's helping to shape the piece to really say, well, what is your approach to it, and what's the, you know, the highway or the avenue in which you're wanting to get there, and how is it your writing different from somebody else's writing that we can help to support you telling the story in your way, in your voice, and so trying to figure out what that is and then ask questions to guide it all the way there.
Don, when we talk about structure, what are things that you respond to or look for structurally in the creation of a play?
Well, I was thinking about when we developed Tortilla Curtain, because we were coming from a source material of a novel by T.C. Boyle, but we couldn't do a whole,
novel.
A whole novel, and so... The playwright had handed us the first draft of the script that had picked certain scenes, but we ended up, I ended up laying out the whole book according to the scenes and mapped which scenes he picked, and then we sort of talked about, did that order need to happen? How do we keep building in a way that, again, is theatrical and, you know, ramps up the tension as we go. It's very different than a way a novel develops. And then we ended up realizing that we ended up throwing out one whole scene that the playwright had written because it just we sort of had gotten the point by that place in the play that These immigrants were having this horrible, terrible life, and it's like, okay, we don't think the audience can stand one more horrible, terrible thing happening to them. We need to move on. Mm-hmm. One of the big challenges in terms of trying to make it theatrical was we knew in the novel there's a giant fire, and then the play ends with a giant mudslide, and it took us a long time to. Will we be able to pull this off technically? And it worked out. But those are other things you have to think about is can your vision actually be realized on the stage at the end of the day?
Mm-hmm. You know, in the plays that I've created this way, there are a few things that I look at structurally. One is that just the idea of variety is that in segments, it's all not happening the same way. So it's simply maybe in one point you're talking to the audience, in another point you're painting, another point there's a song, mm-hmm. another point there's a personal confession. Mm-hmm. Like anything, if it just goes on the same way, I think that gets boring for the audience. And I think one of the things in a theatrical piece, and this piece, History of Mr. the Universe, really follows this, is that you have the audience sitting in a chair for 2 hours, and something happens over that time. And the question is, how do you keep people engaged over that period of time? And we all know that feeling when time seems to stand still, and you're getting engaged. And I often talk about, like, staying ahead of the audience, that the audience doesn't know exactly what's going to follow their surprises. Sam talks about events. Mm-hmm. You know, what is the event of a different scene?
It's the intrigue that keeps the audience.
And then there's the questions, right?
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
Right. What's gonna happen next? Right. So you plant questions that the audience is sort of engaged in figuring out what's going to happen. Yeah, exactly. What are in the creation of Picasso? Mm-hmm. What are the things that you found in the process that you think kind of were particularly engaging to the audience or helped to deepen the work that you found in the process?
And I want to thank you, Todd. Todd was very instrumental in helping me develop the piece from the very, very beginning. And but I think it started as source material, like you said, raw source material. And I was doing it, I was performing in it, but it sounded a little too lecturish, you know, lectury, you know? I don't know if that's a word. But it sounded like a lecture, and like you said, 2 hours of lecture, you zone out. You will zone out. So you have to give it events. You have to give it a variety. But I think one of the keys that we found is that we made the audience the second character. And I think that Sam came up with that idea. He's like, I like where you're going with this, but what if the audience is in the studio with Pablo Picasso, you know? So he's not just talking, you know, to an unknown being. He's actually talking to you, you know, really breaking that fourth wall and talking to you directly. And that really liberated the piece, I think. Then a relationship with the audience started in the piece. And then it was kind of easier to write because now I knew who I was talking to. Otherwise, you don't, you know. For example, is Bucky talking to an audience? To the audience, does he acknowledge the audience?
You'll see an interesting convention in that the play starts and it's as if Bucky is just wandering in the theater.
Oh, okay.
And I don't want to give too much away, but
yeah, but you
I
have
mean,
to give
people,
it some
people
kind of
think
hook.
That he's an usher. And then he just walks on stage and starts to talk to the audience. Mm-hmm. So again,
that's a hook. Yeah, it's the hook, right? And I think you always have to find that hook in a play, you know? How do you hook the audience with? Especially for a one-person play, you really have to find the relationship with the audience because that's all you have, you know? That's all the actor has.
Yeah, so I think that both you and Danielle are talking about, like, what's the frame of the piece? And this idea, not only in Picasso, not only that he's talking to the audience, but the fact that he's got 6 paintings mm-hmm. and 3 vases to complete in a weekend.
And that's the premise of the play. A simple premise. I gave it a simple premise because, you know, you just can't talk the talk. He had to do something. And that's the other thing about a play, right? The protagonist or the actors have to do something. They have to complete something. You want them to, you don't want them to just ramble. You want them to get from A to B, you know? And in this case, it's A to B to C to D, you know? That's what kept the motor going.
So there are a lot of playwrights that hate the way plays are developed in the American theater. I don't know what Bucky would say about this. I mean, there should be synergy amongst people working together, and I think that we can say that we've all found synergy working together. But too often in the American theater, the way plays are created is very prescriptive, mm-hmm. is that you write something, a bunch of people give you notes on what you need to do to make it better, and if you're going to get that play produced at that theater, you better do those notes. Mm-hmm. The other thing that you hear all the time, and I have to tell you, it was a big issue on this piece, is that anything that doesn't seem captivating to the audience should be cut. And so what you'll often get is the people in the theater telling you, cut this, cut this, cut this, cut this. But sometimes there just needs to be time and breath to a piece. And it's not all about flash, flash, flash. It was a big issue on this piece. This piece probably started at 10 hours, ended up at 2 hours. It could be that people want it to be an hour 45, but it stayed at 2 hours, and that was what it was going to be. But what? How do you navigate the relationship between artists in the world of creating a play so that you're involved in the play and your input is there, but it's somehow, you know, a synergistic process and not a prescriptive, fix this baby kind of process? How do you do that, Don?
I feel like I've been really fortunate, and the playwrights that I've worked with have been very open and receptive. So it becomes, I think that all the plays I've worked on, Sam has directed. And so it becomes just feedback, but not like, you must do this. It's like, it's more kind of, I'm getting this from what I'm hearing. This is my personal experience of it. And then a lot of it's asking questions of the playwright and in the act of them having to articulate why they made a particular choice, they often will come to the same conclusion everyone else has about why that may not be quite working that way, but there is another way that will get what they want, that will help the audience respond in the way that they're looking for.
Yeah, we worked with a dramaturg very much like that, Mark Bly.
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember the things that Mark Bly? He's a very illustrious dramaturg in the American theaters. Worked on many very acclaimed new plays, and we worked with him on Picasso. Do you remember what Mark did when we were in rehearsal?
I mean, no. No, but he was very, he listened. He listened, and that's, I think that's the most important thing, right? For a dramaturg to listen where the writing is going, where the, you know, where it's going. And he, I think what Mark saw was he found the heart of the piece, you know. I think that's what it needed, you know. We were feeling it at that point. I don't know if that's what you're referring to. That's what I got out of that.
Yeah, it's in the key meter. He helped us find that Picasso's relationship to the war, the invasion of Hungary, was happening.
Yeah, the heart. Yeah, that's what I meant by the heart.
And
yeah.
Also Picasso's family.
Yeah.
And he then just asked a lot of questions.
Mm-hmm, and that really helped. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, I talked to Mark about the process at a later date, and what he said was he always sees his job as helping the playwright understand what the play is.
Yeah.
It's
why it is, you know.
Yeah.
Why are we even writing it? You know, you have to, sometimes you write it and you're like, well, why am I even doing this? But those are the good questions. And that's what really brings out the heart, what I call the heart of the play, meaning the why does it even exist? You know, why are people even saying what they're saying, you know?
What about you, Danielle? I mean, you happen to be a remarkable researcher, and I think part of what you do is you give materials to the people writing and somehow influence the process by giving this real rich research to them.
Well, I think it also, as Dawn has said, it really depends on who's in the room with you. It's a very different experience if you're handing research or ideas or questions over to somebody who isn't as receptive as somebody as who is. And yourself, like on Hammer and a Bell, and Herb on Still Heaven, and Karen Zacharias, that I'm working with right now. It's so wonderful to feel like you're offering something that is then being taken in and sort of breathed in, and then they breathe out whatever comes of that. You know, that's how I kind of think of it. I'm like, I will hand you things for food for thought, whether it's research or you know, my take on some of the source material or questions that I have as I'm looking at the piece that you have right now, and then let you kind of percolate on that. So that's,
I depend on that feedback. I really do, because I get to a point where I feel like I finished, you know. I'm not finished, but I feel like, okay.
You feel like you that. You feel like that
all every the time. Every time you finish a draft, I'm done.
I'm done.
And then we hand you stuff.
Yeah, but it opens my mind, and I go, yeah, that's a great idea. And I might not use your idea, but it opens the door for me to use, you know, to create other ideas, you know what I'm saying? And so that really helps, just by opening that door. They gave me an alternative. Well, I might not like that alternative, but I create my own, you know?
Well, this approach is for me is because I went through a program where I was I got my degree in fiction writing, and you sit there and you write, and then you have a whole room full of people and you're not allowed to say anything, and they're just picking at your writing and telling you what you should have done differently and what you should and could do, and you're silenced. And so I feel very strongly after going through that experience that the impetus should be, the power should be in the writer's hands. And not only should they lead the questions of, hey, is this working, is this not working, but their vision and their, you know, where the ultimate goal is should be clear and shared with the people who are trying to create that ultimate product. I think that I've handed you things that you haven't always thought of before, but at the same time, I'm always trying to work towards what I hear you saying is your ultimate goal.
You hear. For example, I did an adaptation of The Imaginary Invalid by Molière, and I set it in early California, and, you know, I put, you know, Spanglish in it, and I just made it, you know, early California. And I thought, okay, I'm done. That's a great, you know, adaptation, you know. But it was just a translation of the play. It didn't have my voice in it. Mm-hmm. And a good dramaturg, in this case, Shirley Fishman, says, well, where are you at? You know, where do you want to say in this play? And that's when I start, you know, and she says, well, what do you do? You know, and if you know my work, I do comedy and I do political comedy. That's really my forte. And so I started inserting that style into the play, and then it started becoming my play. Mm-hmm. You know, it wasn't just a translation, and now it became an adaptation of my, you know, my political philosophy, my comic timing, all that. It's now in it now, you know, and now it's really different. Now it's
in a completely different time.
Yeah.
Now, by the time you do it in the fall, there'll be plenty of politics to make fun of.
Yeah. Yeah. Looking forward to that.
Yeah. It's like the perfect setup for Herbert Seguin's play. You won't see the play anymore. It'll just be the politics at that point. Yeah. You know, one of the other things, it's a little bit technical. It's not like exciting, but I find that when you're using source material, you're editing it and thinning it out, mm-hmm. helps to make the energy really strong. Mm-hmm. And that we did this on Picasso, and we did it constantly on Picasso. We did it on the Abbie Hoffman play. It's just like, this is repetitive. You probably have the feeling when you write something and you have a good editor, just come and trim it down. And all of a sudden it gets this energy. I'll give you an example. In the play that I just did in Los Angeles, The Blessing of a Broken Heart, the character describes seeing a shooting star and the shooting star reminding her of something that her own son had said about a son that she had who had unfortunately died being welcomed into heaven or something. And so there's a shooting star. She goes, I walk outside and I see a shooting star, the same shooting star that Gavi told me Kobe would be able to see because he was now with God. And then she had the next line, which was in the book, that said, God is welcoming Kobe. But we took that line out because it gave the conclusion. And when you give the conclusion to the audience, there's a lot more power than when you're told, this is what you should think about this. Mm-hmm. And I think I've learned a lot through editing in letting it be in the audience's hand to be the interpreter. And don't give it in the way that, I mean, if you were listening to the debates tonight on the radio or on computer, it's all about its message, you know, and mm-hmm. how much message could you say quickly? And I think that kills a play. You know, you have to really back off of it and let the audience come to multiple conclusions of what they're seeing. and just guide the audience rather than tell the audience what it is they should think.
And sometimes you have to cut some really great passages or stuff that, you know, that's great, but it just wasn't great at that moment, you know, or in this piece particularly. And it's like you said, it's a timing thing. It's an intuitive thing, you know. And playwriting has changed a lot. I mean, if you look at the classics, the way they repeat an idea over and over again, you know.
Or the pacing.
Yeah.
A lot more patience.
Yeah,
a lot slower, and now there is a certain expectation, and there's typically an expectation of, you know, projections and visuals and quick pace.
Right, exactly. So that's changed. We don't have the, you know, the 4-hour, 3-act plays, Ibsen, you know. They're a lot more, you know, new plays are a lot faster.
I think this last season we had maybe one play. I think this is it, one play with a...
Intermission.
Oh, really? The rest are 90 minutes. That's it. So, just a different trend.
Any questions that we could take? We just have a couple of minutes until we walk back into the world of Buckminster Fuller. Yes?
Water and Power. Who wrote it? And because that's what... I've been coming to the Lyceum Theater for a long time. But that play really... I could relate to it.
Right.
And it captured me, and when I walked out of there, I never forgot. I never forgot the title. I never forgot nothing about it.
That's great.
That's great. Yeah, it's a new play. It was written by Richard Montoya, who's a member of Culture Clash. It was commissioned by the Mark Taper Forum in 2006. So it premiered at the Mark Taper Forum, and then it came here in 2008. But yeah, I think that's one of the great plays as far as. Water and Power is a play about, huh?
You were in it, right?
I was in it, yeah. Water and Power is about two brothers that are twins. One's a politician and one's a police officer. And they get into corruption, L.A. corruption and things like that. And there's a murder mystery, and so it's really great. It's a great, like, film noir, you know, noirish L.A. play. Mm-hmm. It's great. It's a great play. And it all takes place in a hotel room. But I don't know, you know, I helped develop it, but you would have to talk to the writer. I mean, what was your question about the... Well, you just said it was... Do you have a question about the writing?
It was just... No, it was just an outstanding play. It's what captured... I mean, it took me to another level.
Mm, that's great.
Because I could relate to it. And probably as Danielle, you were speaking about attracting the audience into I don't know which words you use, caption or whatever, but that's what hooked me. I have been at the Lyceum Theater. I'm not sure exactly how long, but that's what hooked me, is that Water and Power. And I was like, wow. So it was something that, I'm not saying to do it again, but that was definitely a...
No, it's a great play. Yeah, it really is. One thing I do want to mention about that play is that, as a new work, Latino work, is that the Latinos portrayed in that play are in positions of power, you know. They're a police officer, they're a senator, they're not, you know, a farm worker or an oppressed, you know. It shows, you know, California as it is, L.A. as it is right now, you know. And I think that's what resonates with people, you know.
Oh, interesting.
They see themselves, they see their senators, you know. They are Latino now, you know.
And that's my exposure. I was born and raised in San Diego, and that's my exposure to Latinos, not necessarily a farm worker or this low whatever. My exposure, my experience is Latinos being in all different types of walks of life. So I can appreciate that in that sense for that play, because you do get tired of seeing certain classes of people just portrayed as certain. And so the Lyceum Theater actually has done an outstanding job putting that out there to get other people to think out of their box when it comes to, you know, certain subjects.
I think what Richard saw is that he basically wrote what he saw in L.A. He has, you know, we have friends that are lawyers, that are senators. We knew Villaraigosa, the mayor, before he was in the mayor. We're friends with him. So, the people in power are now us, you know. And power corrupts people, you know, and that's what the play's about, you know, a story about, you know, how people can take power, can get power suddenly and become corrupt.
Other questions? That piece became a film last year. In fact, Richard, the same person who wrote it, then rewrote it as a film, and I think directed it as a film. Yes. Also, did it change when it went from a theater piece to a film?
A lot, a lot.
Really, I never.
It's not. Yeah, it's almost unrecognizable. You know, he really changed it a lot, but you know, and I think that it was just a creative.
Same title. Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's on Netflix. You know, or Amazon.
Ah, very very interesting.
But yeah, he changed it a lot. You know, and a lot of it had to do with you know, getting opinions. You know. He wasn't. He was out of.
Oh, right. When you're doing a film,
he was out of the theater, and now he really relied on the opinions of film people. You know, and they have a whole other way of looking at the process.
And everyone says in a film you have so much less control.
Yeah.
Of what's doing
exactly.
The producers,
because it's fun. You know.
Decide a lot. Yeah. Well, just just as a quick wrap up, like just in a sentence or two, why the theater? Why are you developing new work for the theater? What happens here that doesn't happen elsewhere?
Well, for me, it's the conversation with the audience. I mean, they're right there, and it gets to evolve in a really organic way.
Awesome, great.
For me, it's the all the tools that are offered in the theater. It's something that I think we at the Rep do really well is utilizing the lights, the sound, the sets, the costumes, the projections, the all elements that come with, you know, not just, you know, you have an actor on stage reading the words, but you add all of these elements together in a way that you're really utilizing all of them in order to tell a magical story. So it just feels like you're sitting watching magic happen for 2 hours.
Awesome. Perfect.
I've always seen it as a great educational tool. I mean, that sounds dry, but it really is, you know. As a Latino playwright, I'm very... I feel like there's a responsibility, or at least I'm very conscious that I'm a Latino writer, and so my plays have to inspire, educate, you know, something about Latinos that you didn't know or now can be proud of, or, you know, instead of... So if you see my plays, Water and Power, we're talking about Latinos in power, you know, like, you know, El Henry was California with... after the Anglos have left, you know, say, I envision California as Mexico again in, you know, 100 years, you know what I'm saying? And so, and Manifest Destiny is set in California before the Gringos came, you know what I'm saying? So it's like, I want to show people how we interact, you know, without the dominant culture above us, you know?
Well, I hope that the discussion tonight gives you a perspective on the construction and the uniqueness of the piece that you're going to get to see tonight that was developed in this process and in part with a great supportive dramaturg, Al Irvine, working on it that we honor through this production. Mm-hmm. So I want to thank Don Moore, Danielle Ward, Herbert Seguenza, and thank you for joining us for the first off-site version of Talking with Todd. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to Repcast, the official podcast of San Diego Repertory Theater. Please visit sdrep.org on the web for more information about the remaining performances in our spectacular 40th season and a preview of what's to come in our 41st season. San Diego Repertory Theater produces intimate, exotic, provocative theater. We promote a more inclusive community through vivid works that nourish progressive, political, and social values and celebrate multiple voices of our region. San Diego Repertory Theater feeds the curious soul.